Hello, everybody, and welcome to the extended free preview of this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie All About Chicken Run. I'm one of your hosts, Bob Mackey, and I'm the guy who doesn't want to be a pie. Who's here with me today?
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, back from holiday.
Exactly, or solitary confinement, as we call it. But yes, this month we're taking a very long look at Chicken Run, the first Aardman DreamWorks collaboration. And hey, it's the first Aardman feature-length film, and they've made about five others so far because it takes a very long time.
And still the most profitable stop-motion film of all time.
Yes, it's a great movie, a very British movie, and you're going to hear a portion of the very, very long podcast we put together. You're going to hear a bit about the history, you're going to hear about the legendary great man Jeffrey Katzenberg and how he recruited some unknown British folks to make a wonderful movie about chickens.
Yeah, there's so much fun history to it, and of course we talk about the very British cast, except for one guy who nobody likes.
Yeah,
now.
And he's not even American.
Yeah, he's what a lie, that Rocky Rhodes.
Yes,
yeah.
But yes, if you want to hear the entire podcast, not just this little portion, head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, sign up for the $10 level, and you can access the rest of this podcast, as well as like 4.5 years so far of What a Cartoon Movies. They're all between 3 to 5 hours. Sometimes they're close to seven, if we're talking about Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and they cover things, as Henry likes to say, from Akira to a Goofy movie. But if you name a movie that's animated and popular, we've probably covered it, even some unpopular ones, and it's all waiting for you behind that $10 paywall at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. And there is a $5 stuff happening behind that paywall that you can access when you're on the $10 level. Go figure. And what are those things, Henry?
Oh man, you know, on top of the $10 things you get at the premium level, you get monthly episodes of Talking Futurama and Talk King of the Hill. Each month we go through a new episode of each of those series. We're in season 4 of Futurama, season 3 of King of the Hill, and that's in addition to all of the completed series we've covered, like every episode of The Critic, every episode of Mission Hill, and a bunch of our favorite episodes of Batman, the animated series. It is a huge back catalog you get with tons new every month if you are at that $5 level, and then even more if you go to that $10 level at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
And if you've never signed up for Patreon before, it's so easy to do. And once you sign up, you're given a code. You just drop that code into whatever you use to listen to podcasts. And that way you can listen to all of our bonus podcasts alongside your free podcast as part of your podcasting lifestyle. And Patreon also has an app for any smart device. You can access our bonus content that way too. But no matter what way you do it, it is so easy to access all of the content waiting for you behind the paywall at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. That's it for our little sales pitch. Now get ready to listen to our excellent podcast about Chicken Run. So let's talk about Aardman and DreamWorks and their connection. We covered a little bit of it in Were-Rabbit. Here's the whole story. So with 1990s Creature Comforts, 1993's The Wrong Trousers, and 1995's A Close Shave, Aardman and Wallace and Gromit were making waves because all of these shorts won the Oscar that year. So they had won 3 Oscars before they made any feature films.
And Americans do not pay attention to British cartoons normally, and certainly don't want to make big Hollywood deals with them until they actually win an Oscar. And winning that many Oscars, it probably helped a lot that the short subject up to 1995 wasn't owned by Pixar. Actually was room to grow and win something there.
It's almost all, I mean, there's been a few shakeups here and there, but Pixar is just like, we submitted our Oscar ticket this year. Please hand over the Oscar.
Pixar didn't win this year.
Yeah.
Did they
win for Belle? Did they win for that?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Deservedly so. That's that one I love. That's my favorite short they've maybe ever done.
I know it's a real crowd pleaser.
Yes, yeah.
So Aardman was actually producing a lot of animation between A Close Shave and Chicken Run, but they was just in the form of shorts, like one or two a year between 95 and 2000. But to Americans, they just disappeared after A Close Shave. Like, we didn't know, unless you were reading Variety or Entertainment Weekly, you didn't know where Aardman went. You didn't know where these weird British characters had gone and if they would ever be back.
Yeah, we didn't really understand how long it takes for them to make one movie.
Yes, and I don't even know how long it took for the Wallace and Gromit shorts to actually be released. I don't know if A Close Shave came out in like 95 here, or maybe probably 96, maybe even 97. I don't know how long they took. I just remember getting them in like late high school on VHS.
Yeah, no, I remember I had probably the same VHS box set as you that had the like bright primary colors for each, a cassette for each short.
Yes. like what are they, 20 minutes each?
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. Then, they'd all have the same opening thing like, and if you have this one, buy the other one. It's like, I bought the VHS, guys.
Yeah,
and
they're adjacent to each other.
Yeah.
So now we have to talk about the hero and the villain of What a Cartoon. Yes, it's been a while, but let's talk about Jeffrey Katzenberg once again.
Man, when was the last... he came up in Tokyo Godfathers because...
Right.
Really just because sideways. We talked more about it in Millennium Actress, but yeah, but it's been a while since we've really talked about the Katzman.
Well, there's a lot of him in this, and you know what? He comes off looking pretty good, I'll say.
Okay.
So after Aardman wins the short in 1990 for Creature Comforts, Nick Park, who's one of the main Aardman guys, the creator of Wallace and Gromit, he sticks around in LA to do some press. And it was then that Jeffrey Katzenberg requested a meeting with him way back in 1990. This is a decade before the release of Chicken Run and 6 years before the DreamWorks contract. I keep wanting to say Dreamcast, and I apologize. DreamWorks came first.
Yes, yeah. They stole Sega, ripped them off, really.
Yeah, I think so. Could we have Dreamcast without DreamWorks? I don't know.
You know, I could still see even without DreamWorks that a Japanese company would have that kind of weird portmanteau. I think so. But yeah, but time to talk about a thing much more successful than the Dreamcast.
Yes, Walt Disney in 1990, very successful. Nick Park kind of vaguely knows who Katzenberg is. He's not aware of his status within Disney. I'm sure he's aware that he's riding high off of Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast is like 6 months away. So it's a very pivotal time for Disney at this point.
Right. So because at those Oscars where Creature Comforts would have won in 90, that's where Little Mermaid would have won for Under the Sea for song. And that's the first time Disney got back on the Oscar list in forever, thanks to that. So, yeah, I could see Katzenberg swinging his dick around, but hey, look.
Swinging his Diet Pepsi around? Diet Coke. Hey, Diet Coke.
You're right, Diet Coke.
It's Diet Coke. Only the sickest executives drink that.
But I guess 1990, they're still not Beauty and the Beast yet. They're still, it could still be viewed as like, well, Little Mermaid was like, you got lucky once, your next movie's not going to be as big a hit.
We covered it, it's the true prestige Disney return to form, right? Mm-hmm. Nick Park has this meeting with Katzenberg, and he knows he's being courted by Katzenberg. And to be fair to Katzenberg, he actually knew a lot about Aardman and Nick Park. Like, he did his research, and he was a fan of them. And he knew he was trying to be headhunted, so Nick Park was like, listen, I'm loyal to Aardman. I have to talk to my folks back home, but, you know, it was very nice to meet you. They parted on cordial terms, but he knew that, like, oh, Katzenberg wants me to work for Disney, and that's it.
That's exactly what happened after Roger Rabbit, that Katzenberg offered, like, every major animator on that a shitload of money to come to work at Disney, and most did it. The Andreas Deja, he only did it because he's like, look, money isn't what I want. And they're like, well, we also have the Disney archives of your favorite artists, like Ward Kimball. He's like, that I'll take. Like, I'll do that.
I think they also wanted to get away from Richard Williams, correct?
There's also that, yeah. It was a combo of those things. It's like, well, do I want to take a bunch of extra money and move, in most cases, move back to America? Or do I want to stay in England and keep working with Richard Williams on The Thief and the Cobbler? Like, man, I rarely comment on Reddit, but I got mad in the Blank Check Reddit where somebody was trying to argue that they should cover Richard Williams instead of Satoshi Kon, and I was like, fuck you.
How many Richard Williams movies are there?
There's really, they already did Roger Rabbit, and it's not his movie.
Right.
So it's really just Thief and the Cobbler, which he didn't finish, and then like the Raggedy Ann and Andy movie, which he didn't finish, and then TV
Ziggy's
specials.
Gifts?
Yeah. Which also he didn't finish. Like, it's all this, I hope that I have, in our research for Roger Rabbit, I hope I dispelled for some people that Richard Williams is not just the put upon genius destroyed by Hollywood. But our Nick Park, to get back to the subject, seems like the total opposite of Richard Williams.
Yes, he seems like a very nice bloke. Is that the word?
Yeah.
Chap, perhaps?
Yeah, chappy, yeah.
I know that Nick Park has hung out with a friend of the show, Ian Boothby. He was even on Ian's podcast.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that. Oh,
I should have been there, man. I wanted to meet Nick Park. But yes, Nick Park, very nice guy, very humble guy. And that's his meeting with Katzenberg in 1990. As early as 1990, Katzenberg's like, I want on the Aardman train and I want it now.
I mean, he's probably approaching it the same way they were approaching Pixar, too. Of just like, you guys, they were the other kings of the short subject Oscars at the time. And so I can see why Disney comes a calling in both of those cases.
Yeah, Pixar is a part of this story, too. Oh, okay. It'll play into it. So the early 90s saw Aardman have like a slightly rocky history with Hollywood because people wanted to do things with their properties, but they were being mishandled. One studio that went unnamed in the book wanted to adapt Creature Comforts into a half-hour show, but they wanted to lose the whole like man on the street interview aspect of Creature Comforts, which was the point of it. It's like, we're going to take this interview audio and turn it into a fun claymation animal animation that reflects upon what the person is saying. And that's the point of it all.
Yeah, that's the entire reason to do it. That's, man, the timing of it sounds like it's post-Bart Mania.
Yeah.
And they're like, a TV show, do that. And also, there's no way they could produce anything half as good to even make 13 episodes of that in a year. Like, no way.
There's no way in hell that they would able be. I don't even know how it was pitched or what it would be. But yeah, that was one of the things that they were trying to work on that didn't pan out. So the Oscar win for The Wrong Trousers happens. That's like, I believe at the 94 Oscars, Aardman is like, we should make a feature film. The last British cartoon feature film was Watership Down, the last one of note. And at that point, that was 15 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, the money really wasn't there for it, I guess. You know, like the British animation, I mean, it was known, but yeah, mainly their best blokes were working on commercials for things starring Tony the Tiger and his British chum, who annoyed me. I was like, you should just have Tony the Tiger.
He had a British chum?
Yeah, he was like, oh no, Tony, he's stealing the Krispies.
Was like, he like, yeah, the little sprout to the big green giant or something?
Let me see. Yeah, kind of. You know what? Now I'm going to have to look it up. I said it. Let's see.
While you look it up, I can talk about what happens next. So yes. At this point, Aardman hires a guy named Michael Rose because they need someone to head up development of projects. They're all animators and craftsmen and things. They need a business guy. And at that point, Aardman is so small that Michael Rose is their 13th employee. That even after two Oscar wins, they still have 12 people at Aardman.
That is so in the opposite of the American style of staff up as fast as you can. Like that is so the but I love that they kept it small like that.
So who is this British man? I think you found him.
I still haven't found him. Wait. In England, they are called Kellogg's Frosties.
Frosties.
And he has a little pal who's like unnamed in this commercial. But the character I was thinking of is the villain of it that Tony the Tiger fights, which is Tiger Man.
But the only villain he fought in the American commercials was hunger.
In this case, he's stealing the Frosties from them. And he's like a villainous Tony the Tiger. But Tony, though, still, they did not recast him for England. He has his American accent. It's
Thurl Ravenscroft?
Yes, good old Thurl.
Is that his real name?
I think it is. Now I'm unsure. Now you've said that.
I want to make sure we're stopping to do a lot of research on this podcast about things that aren't important. Yes, Thurl Ravenscroft. That's him.
Yeah, no, this also, whenever I see people repost like commercials for Simpsons that were in other countries, it's so funny that like in English-speaking countries like Australia or England, sometimes the promotional person on it will speak in an American accent, and other times they'll just have a British accent.
I like when it's like, Bart and Homer are in big trouble this week.
You can never say, yeah, I've put it in the podcast a couple times, the a Bart cereal commercial where Bart and Homer, it is animated by the real Simpsons people, but they clearly didn't spend the money on getting Nancy or Dan, so it's just silent, and then a British person says, "Bye, Bolt, see you."
We needed that over here.
You're going to hear a lot of bad British accents from
they're going to we'll go to like South Africa, and they're going to take a trip to Australia, our accents, but please be kind. So yeah, Michael Rose is hired head of development at Pixar. At that point, when Rose arrived at the studio, there was a standing offer from Disney for a three-picture deal. And this deal was essentially identical to the deal that Pixar had signed around that time, which means it sucked. And go back to our Toy Story podcast and our Toy Story 2 podcast to find out why Pixar got so royally screwed and how that eventually led to them being consumed.
It took a whole lot of money to fix that problem eventually.
Yes.
Thanks to... the one thing Bob Iger is good at is writing giant paid checks to companies.
That's... It's the best thing. Great signature on those checks. Yeah. At some point in 1994, Michael Rose convinced Peter Lord and David Sproxton, the founders of Pixar, to arrange a meeting with Disney because he's like, you have this contract sitting on your desk. You need to at least talk to these people. And apparently... this meeting went very poorly. Michael Rose recounts that there was like basically a 20-minute exchange of ideas, and then he asked, well, what would happen to the rights to our projects if they don't get made? And then someone at Disney responded, well, if you're going to get married, you have to sort out the divorce arrangements first. So up front, they were very cynical. And they're like, okay, listen, guys, you sweet British people, go talk to John Lasseter. Go talk to Henry Selick. They're doing their own stuff for us. And see what they have to say. And then they added, and if you don't sign this deal, you'll never make a movie in this town.
Ooh, boy. So, they're playing hardball at Disney.
Yeah.
Man.
They're like, oh, you're so cute with your little rights. You know,
it's so funny, man. Well, also, because they're probably big time in these British folks.
Yeah.
Who think they're like, you should be, think you're very lucky that we even want to make this deal with you. We're Disney. We're freaking Disney. And yeah. Disney would not let anybody keep the rights to something. They would never, ever do that.
Absolutely. So very brief reminder that Pixar, when they signed the deal, Disney owned the characters and they could make sequels on their own without the involvement of Pixar. That's what happened to Toy Story 2. Disney made their own and then Pixar saw how it was going and they stepped in and then started their own movie from scratch. And that's essentially the Toy Story 2 we know and love, made by grueling labor in about a year.
I also wonder, too, if they... I mean, Disney would have been this shitty in general, but this is right after they were left in a tricky position with Roger Rabbit because they actually did share ownership with Amblin, and that caused problems when they tried to steamroll over Spielberg, and Spielberg's like, well, then fuck you. I'm not making it anymore.
It caused problems and it caused Bonkers to happen.
Yes. What would the world be like without Bonkers, though?
Every 6 months, I have to remind people of this. You know the cute story that you hear on Twitter every, I don't know, let's say 6 to 8 weeks about how, oh, Toy Story was almost lost, but one person had the computer and they saved the day. That version of the movie was the movie they threw away anyways. It was the bad version that you never saw.
If that woman hadn't saved it, it wouldn't make a difference.
Yes.
Honestly. Maybe they would have quit. They'd have scrapped it all sooner. They're like, well, since it got lost anyway.
Make sure you tell people this. If you hear that story, you have to tell them they're wrong. Destroy friendships. Destroy relationships with family members. Let them know they're wrong about this.
Google it. Show them to it. Or just play them our podcast. Yeah. That, I think, will be a great introduction to our
podcast. Sit them down for 6 hours. So, yes, there's a bad meeting with Disney. Disney is being very executive-y, very corporate, saying, yeah, listen, John Lasseter's making Toy Story. Henry Selick's made Nightmare Before Christmas. They don't own their crap, and they're happy, so go talk to them and see how we treat them, and you better fucking sign our contract. Essentially, that's how it works.
Yeah, again, there's also little competition. Where else are they going to take it to for an American-sized budget on something? Like, they're already seeing that the other studios, when they try to do animation, at this point in the first half of the 90s, all of them are like, oh, wait, it costs that much? Like, oh, no. They always, or if they even finish the cartoon, then they're like, well, we're not going to promote this. And this is the first and last animated movie we're putting out.
And then we're going to take it off streaming. In the future, that's what they'll say. We're going to take it off streaming. No one will see it again. And it'll be a nice tax write-off for us. So Katzenberg reappears in this story 5 years after he first emerged. So actually 6 years. So he shows up with some big Diet Coke can energy, let's call it that, in January of 1996. So Aardman is invited to screen A Close Shave at Sundance, and this venue could potentially attract Hollywood studios to Aardman. And I think A Close Shave was just on the brink of winning an Oscar. It would win an Oscar that March. So Aardman met with execs from American studios, but DreamWorks was not there. What happens next is a Hollywood producer named Jake Eberts, who Aardman had been working with, he produced Selick's James and the Giant Peach. So they got in touch with him in terms of, like, help us make it in Hollywood, like, help us produce things in Hollywood. They're working with him at this point.
Yeah, and if folks don't remember from our Shrek podcast or the Lion King one, Jeffrey Katzenberg basically gets fired by Michael Eisner, and then, like, the next day he announces with Steven Spielberg and David Geffen they have a brand new movie studio, and it's going to change everything.
They're going to make dreams.
DreamWorks SKG. Spielberg, Katzenberg, Geffen.
And I forget, do they still make live action stuff?
No, that all got sold off a while ago. I thought so. Because when Spielberg makes, I mean, yeah, this skips way to the end, but yeah, DreamWorks animation outlasted the live action when it came to DreamWorks, and it still is technically a brand, the DreamWorks animation. DreamWorks live action movies, no, that's not a thing anymore.
Okay, I didn't think so. So yeah, Jake Ebert's he calls Katzenberg because he's like, okay, we should get in touch with DreamWorks, this new upcoming studio, see what's going on with them. And Katzenberg's in LA, so instead of flying out to Salt Lake City to meet with Aardman, Katzenberg basically sends out a private jet to pick up the Aardman folks and fly them into LA.
That's
so,
really showing off.
And not just to fly them to LA, but to have dinner with him and Steven Spielberg.
Holy cow. Yeah. He's rolling out the red carpet for these guys.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we'll come back to that story later. Okay. Let's get into the history of Chicken Run. So Nick Park comes up with the kernel of the story as early as 1994.
A kernel of the feed that they
Yes, perhaps, perhaps. And this kernel of the story is just a drawing of a chicken trying to tunnel under a fence with a spoon, and that's essentially it. And this idea, this drawing evolves into an idea, which is the pitch for Chicken Run. A prisoner of war movie with chickens, and that's as simple as it is.
Yeah, I think as we saw in The Simpsons too, around this time, that like films like The Great Escape and other prisoner of World War II prisoner of war movies were so big to Gen X guys.
Yes,
and I wonder if it was even more powerful to. I mean, definitely you see like Quentin Tarantino it loves them too. But I wonder if it had like an even bigger effect on Brits too, because they did feel the effects of World War II more than we did.
They were being bombed. We just got bombed once.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, I mean, this is also a period of great World War II nostalgia, because The Greatest Generation were dying, and we had Saving Private Ryan, we had Band of Brothers, like the late 90s into the early aughts. I mean, we're always talking about World War II. I think only now we're like, what about World War I? What if it was all quiet on the Western Front?
Ugh, yeah, because that's like 100 now. So, yeah. Yeah. Or, well, no, it's 110 years old.
It's been a bit. But yeah. I mean, like tons of video games about World War II. It was the perfect time to strike while the iron was hot.
Yeah. And also, I guess they're meeting with Spielberg. Like, you pitch a World War II type idea to Spielberg. I don't know if that's what happened, but I've said it before, but like what we envision, maybe just this is our generation. I don't know how it is for younger people. When I imagine World War II, I just see mainly Spielberg movies.
Yes.
Like he defines what it is in our imagination.
I just watched one recently and I forget what it is. I'm sorry, but I was surprised. Like World War II is in this one too. it was shocking to me. But yes, like you said, Henry, this is inspired by The Great Escape and a bunch of other prisoner of war movies that are less well known. But this is not a parody of that movie. The events are much different. If this was a parody of The Great Escape, the ending would be much more depressing.
Oh,
like
yeah.
Two chickens would make it out.
That's true. Yeah. Rocky would get shot in the back and the escape attempt.
I mean, it's a 65-year-old movie at this point, but it's like a 60-year-old movie. But The Great Escape, that title is misleading. It's like The Great Escape and then the eventual assassination of the people who escaped.
Right, yeah.
That's essentially how it works out. It's also a three-hour movie. I kind of want to watch it again, but you got to set aside a whole like half a day for that.
It's been a long time since I've seen it. I probably only watched it to get references that were in The Simpsons.
Yeah, that's why I watched it too. So David Proxton and Nick Park, they sketch out a lot of ideas for this concept, a lot of visual gags. But when it came to actually writing a plot for a feature film, they were completely new to it. And they say in the book, like, all of the preliminary ideas that we wrote down would have taken 4 hours to play out on the screen. So they needed somebody who knew how to push these ideas into the three-act mold of a feature film.
Right, yeah. I mean, that for it being somebody's first feature film, Chicken Run is such a tidy 90 minutes that now to hear that it sounds like it took them a long time to get it to fit to that.
I get the feeling, and I'm going to read the entire book. I only read the Chicken Run parts for this history, but I get the feeling that these guys, they love like silent comedy and they love physical comedy, and they're not as much as into dialogue and emotions. Like Nick Park says, we're not sentimental, we're British. We need people to import that to us, and you need that in a movie, so we can't do that. And it feels like this could have been the premise for a bunch of shorts, not necessarily 20-minute ones, but they were talking on the commentary, like, all the things you see Ginger do in the opening 5 minutes, he said those could all have potentially been shorts.
Yeah, those could have just run as, like, 90-second interstitials on, like, BBC Four or whatever.
But instead,
yeah,
they threw out all of those ideas in one montage.
It's a great montage.
It's amazing. Oh. I like how it just starts with that. It's so great. So, yes, go to January of 1996. They have Chicken Run in their mind as the movie they want to pitch when they're being flown out to L.A. to meet with Katzenberg. At that point, they are going to pitch this, but Katzenberg doesn't know it. But for some reason, Katzenberg takes them to a high-end chicken restaurant. He's like, you guys, they'd make the best chicken here. You got to try the chicken. It's out of this world. And they're like, he has no idea. We're going to pitch a movie that is the, like, the contradiction of what he wants to do here.
Oh, that's so funny, because you would think he would want to take him to, like, either super fancy sushi or a great steak place.
Could he take them to Dive yet? Was Dive open?
Oh, right, man. And, well, and also I know that Katzenberg loves his sushi, because the original name he wanted for Tubi, not Tubi, Quibi. How
there you go.
I forget that.
It's so timeless.
But the original name he wanted for Quibi was Omakase, because that's his favorite order at a sushi place.
Of
which
course.
Is just what the chef picks out.
It's also usually the most expensive thing at
yes,
sushi place.
Yeah. Well, what's he care? I bet he has never paid for something in a very long time.
Absolutely not. Yeah. So the funny thing is Spielberg arrives late, like very Spielberg-y, wearing jeans and a baseball cap and sunglasses. He's looking like the Spielberg we know and love. And that's when they pitch their idea and they say, we want to do The Great Escape with chickens. And Spielberg is like, I love it. And that's all you need.
Yeah.
That's all you need. Like, the power of Spielberg, I mean, go back to our Freakazoid episodes. Freakazoid was going to be like a Batman the Animated Series style superhero show. And he's like, oh, why don't you guys make it funny? And then it changes everything instantly.
Once he says it, it's like, well, I guess we're just going to go in the other direction. Yeah, that's so great. So I swear that came up in other DreamWorks stuff I saw too, that like when Spielberg says it, then Katzenberg is like, well, all right then.
Yes.
Like, he barely has any choice after that.
He has to he has executive power, but Steven Spielberg is Steven Spielberg, especially at this time. Steven Spielberg, he is like right off of Jurassic Park and going to make The Lost World a shitty movie, but one that's very popular.
And Schindler's List as well.
Yeah.
So he has... Not only does he still prove that, like, I can make you a billion-dollar movie, but also now I have the respectability of an Oscar with me, too. Yeah, it's if a director had done 10% in their career what Steven Spielberg had done, has done, it would be, you know, it would be one of the greatest careers in cinema. Like,
and he's still doing it.
Yeah, it's,
I hope he just becomes a Clint Eastwood figure and just doing it for the next 15 years at least.
It's man, that Fableman's movie, I liked it. It shouldn't have won Best Picture, and it didn't need to.
Oh, but this is the first I'm hearing of this.
Yeah, it was really, really great. Mm. If you've followed his career the whole time, it was also funny because I watched people say, like, oh, if you think that Michelle Williams plays his mom kind of big or whatever, look up videos of his mom doing interviews. Like, oh, no, she didn't play his mother big at all. Like, actually, she toned down his mom a little bit.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Still got to see it. Still really want to see it.
It's really great. I own it forever. I'll tell you what. Don't watch it with your mom. It feels weird watching it with your mom who has gone through a divorce. And that's kind of what the movie is.
It's also a very Oedipal movie appearing.
It is. Oh, yeah. No, that's honestly, that's the funniest thing that Spielberg is now up front of, just like, yeah, look, I had a hot mom, okay? And it did confuse me a lot. Like,
that'll mess you up.
Yeah.
So they're very lucky in that Spielberg likes their idea. So Spielberg tells them, when I was young, like, The Great Escape was my favorite movie. So he's already on board there.
I forgot that's actually in the Fablemans. Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. And also, at the time, he owned a chicken ranch near Malibu that had 300 chickens. I hope it was just for eggs. I hope it wasn't where they're killing chickens.
Wow. Man, yeah. I never knew. Boy, that's crazy.
So this was the guy to hear the pitch. He's Steven Spielberg. He loves The Great Escape, and he has 300 chickens.
That is the luckiest day, man. Oh, that's amazing.
So, yeah, they had the confidence immediately of having Steven Spielberg like their ideas. So Nick Park and Peter Lord talk through their ideas for Chicken Run, detailing, like, here is how a prisoner of war camp is like a chicken ranch. And by the way, I need to point out the very amazing pun in the title, Chicken Run. A chicken run is an enclosed area in which chickens live on a farm. It's called a chicken run, but it's also, run could be like, the chickens are going to escape. It's a chicken run.
I never knew that. I never knew that. I just took it as like, yeah, the chickens are running. Like, wow, man. And the opening is so great too. Like, you, obviously, if you sat down for the movie, you know it's about chickens. But the opening is like, if you just switch to it on TV, it is just framed like this is a World War II prison camp with human guards and dogs.
They say on the commentary they want to mislead you, even though you paid money to see Chicken Run, to like, are these people? And I think, honestly, I think this is the last time in history we could have had fun with like Nazi imagery and prisoner of war imagery, because I'm not trying to be cute or funny or anything. But it is interesting to think of a movie about a prisoner of war camp where the fate of the prisoners is being in an oven. And I don't know if that was on their minds, but I think that imagery would be too loaded now to be as playful with, I think.
You know what? Having Spielberg give it a stamp of approval, any fears of it being like, no, hey, doesn't this evoke the Holocaust? Like, hey, Spielberg approved it, so
and,
it's okay.
And the female owner of the ranch is kind of like a Nazi commandant or whatever. I mean,
oh, man, she pretty much just wears jack boots, you know? Like, yeah.
But I felt like, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with this, but I feel like this is the last time we could really play around with this and have fun with this imagery. And because we're in the area of World War II becoming like this pop culture phenomenon, and we're not thinking as much about like, oh, actual people like suffered horribly. And I mean, I know Spielberg made Schindler's List, but he's still having fun with it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that is the fun of like, no. This is about Great Escape, which is about soldiers fighting their guards. You don't have to think about the Holocaust as much because you're like, no, this is, though. How do you not think about it? I mean, yes, it occurred to me a few times watching it, though. The ovens thing, I was like, oh, right. Yeah. When you just said, I was like, yeah, actually, yeah, that's really eerie and gross. Yeah.
I mean, they're trying hard to make it like a prisoner of war camp, like they're soldiers or whatever that were, you know, taken in. But they're also like creatures who are viewed as lesser, you know, by like another race, basically.
Yeah, yeah, there is that. I mean, it really helps a lot how British they are, that you don't think of them as, not that there aren't British Jewish people, obviously, but they're just so very white British people that and having especially Fowler there, it makes you think of like, well, no, this is he is the head sergeant of a platoon that got caught by the Nazis and they're in a prison camp together. So I'm always thinking military, thanks to Fowler talking about his time in the RAF.
And also, in every movie, up to a certain point, British people played Nazis.
Yes.
Even in Star Wars. But then everyone is British in this movie.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about Andor. They finally got back to casting British people as the Empire because they are... It needs to be jerky British people, though it's still... I've complained about this too much. I do want more diversity in Star Wars. I feel like the Empire, though, should be a white nationalist fascist group. And if you diversify it, it kind of loses the point of making the Empire a white nationalist evil group. But
that could be the only one of those Star Wars shows I watch.
It's
unless they make a better one.
No, you should just watch that.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah.
So, yes, they go through their ideas, talk about, you know, here are the like correlations between our scenario in the prisoner of war camp. And at this point, they decided to go forward with their deal with DreamWorks. We can cover that. We talked about it in Wallace and Gromit. That was like a while ago. So this is a $250 million deal to release 4 films over 12 years. These things make a long time to make, people. They take a long time to make. But they only got as far as their third film that was Flushed Away. And that's when the partnership ended semi-amicably. So what caused the split was that DreamWorks went public in October of 2004. And Katzenberg might have tolerated a flop, but the shareholders would not. Mm. And that's what ended their contract.
God, it's really, man, once you bring in shareholders to this thing, like it all gets so gross and bad. You have to answer to all of the jerks out there. Like, yeah, there's positives to a public company is that, say, while I'm seeing this with the World Wrestling Entertainment Group, is that since they're a public company, they're up to much more scrutiny over Vince McMahon trying to come back, and he wants it to go private again so he can't be fired for being a multiple-time sexual assaulter, like, allegedly.
Right.
But this is one of the other sides. When you go public, you have to always expand. You got to be bigger and bigger and bigger than the previous year.
And shareholders, on the most part, for the most part, are dumb assholes. If you ever hear the reports of like the shareholder calls, the dumbest questions by the most ignorant people who have no idea what they invested in. They're great.
Nintendo had some very funny ones.
I'm thinking of the Nintendo ones. One of the agreements that was part of the split was that DreamWorks would retain the rights to one Aardman project in development, and that was called Crude Awakening, and that eventually came out in the form of The Croods in 2013. But then Aardman was like, we'll make our own caveman comedy and call it Early Man. But that was also a big flop.
It
was on their own terms.
At least they failed on their own terms. Yeah. People have told us we should check out The Croods, that it's a good one.
And then there was like a Crude sequel that came out like right when the pandemic was really raring.
That's right, man. Crude sequel out of nowhere. But yeah, I guess, unfortunately, Shrek... This is the year before Shrek, and Shrek fucks everything up for what DreamWorks is going to produce. I think Aardman came out a little better than 2D animation in the DreamWorks profile.
Absolutely, and I guess we should remind people that DreamWorks was trying everything for animation. They're like, what about ants? What about Bible cartoons? What about stop motion? They were trying everything before they figured out Shrek, and that... they recovered 10 years later, but it was kind of downhill artistically from there, but uphill financially.
Everything had to be the Shrek template after that. They dumped out Sinbad and the Aardman stuff they were working on, but really what they were interested in was the cocked eyebrow of famous people talking through CGI creatures.
What if they looked like fish? Go, make it.
But make sure people know it's Will Smith. You better draw Will Smith's face on a fish.
So a few months after this meeting with Katzenberg and Spielberg, that's when A Close Shave wins the Oscar, and DreamWorks is so excited to get this script for Chicken Run. But the problem is it's not ready because they don't know how to write a movie script. So to whip their idea into the form of a feature, Aardman hires a man called Jack Rosenthal. That's right. None other than the co-writer of Yentl.
Oh, whoa.
She put the she in Yeshiva. I'm sure it's a fine movie. The joke was Homer is too much of a lout to enjoy it. But yes, he was a British writer. He wrote for a ton of British things, including 122 episodes of Coronation Street. Now, by the way, we're going to skirt over a lot of the British talent because our audience is mostly American. If I told you what these people worked on, you would have no idea. And I also think it's kind of patronizing, but I often think it's kind of cute. They have their own little like movies and TV shows over there, don't they? And a radio show. How nice for them. But there's a lot of entertainment happening in the UK that barely comes over here. I mean, it's now more available with streaming, of course, but... there's still like just so many celebrities who never leave that bubble, and I think that's great for them.
Yeah, I love that too about British entertainment. I know I mock the Brits a bunch, or I have some negative things, especially about video games. It is because I worked for British people who a lot of them I was not the biggest fan of but I've always loved British culture and comedy, especially that came over here. Like I always loved, like, not just the Aardman productions, but like Monty Python was some of the first like comedy I ever saw. I felt like I was the only person in my friend group who ever heard of Alan Partridge for the longest time. And like, or the show Phoenix Nights, like that got turned on to me by a British pal.
I like Red Dwarf more than Star Trek or Star Wars.
I love
Red
Dwarf.
But I like Spaceballs more than Star Wars.
That's true.
I'm always like, where are the jokes?
No, I love Red Dwarf, yes. And look, does another thing suck about that half the British people I liked growing up are now like mega transphobes? Like, yeah, it sucks. It really sucks. But, they can't all be as great as... knock on wood, Steve Coogan has stayed good this whole time.
Well, I was watching a Red Dwarf retrospective, and I thought to myself, I'm not going to look up any of their Twitter accounts, just to be safe. You never know.
Yeah, I feel like...
Well, with anybody over 60, you never know. British people, I love you, but there's something in the water over there when it comes to transphobia.
Yeah, it's pretty bad on Turf Island.
Or maybe you just have more notable transphobes. That could be it.
Maybe. I mean, certainly, like, yeah, I mean... here we are as Americans acting like we don't have transphobes here. It's like, no, of course it's horrible.
Look
here.
At the laws being passed here. Yeah. I assume it's worse, but it's more concentrated in the UK.
Yeah. I mean, I guess because they're a smaller group on their little island over there in their foggy little island. But,
yes.
But anyway, yes, all the British content factories out there, they make good stuff. And there's a lot of good actors in this, but who are not famous. And I could not believe that Katzenberg only made them cast one movie star in this.
Yeah, okay. But he was that big, and I think that's what made it work. But yes, so Jack Rosenthal, first writer on the movie, he turns in a script. There's nothing wrong with it, but it doesn't really align with what Park and Lord have in mind for the story. So they turn to a guy named Kerry Kirkpatrick. He is an American. So an American ends up writing this movie. He's an Anglophile. He's actually 30 years younger than the other writer they hired previously. He's 30 years younger than Rosenthal. And he's also the adapter of the Selleck version of James and the Giant Peach. So that was one of his credits before this, along with The Rescuers Down Under.
Oh, well, I mean, that's if you as an American can adapt a Roald Dahl thing, then you're enough of an Anglophile to work with Aardman. Yeah,
absolutely. And like after this, he also adapted Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, that film. I've never seen it. I heard it's fine. It's like an impossible book to adapt.
Yeah, that's what I listened to the original radio play of it. I never actually read the book, but... So when I say I enjoyed that movie, know that I'm not a hardcore fan, and I know hardcore fans, like I would with a Spider-Man movie, can go like, oh, well, they changed that. I never imagined Zaphod Beeblebrox would be like this guy, but I laughed at the movie. It was funny.
Well, from my understanding, in Hitchhiker's Guide, the radio plays are just the purest form. The books came after, right?
Yeah, that's, I believe so, yeah.
It's crazy that there's still radio in the UK. I think it's because one awful corporation didn't buy every radio station and turn it into right-wing propaganda.
It like wasn't as privatized. Yeah. I think.
But it's like, some of these people still make, like, have radio shows, and things in the 21st century, like The Office, started as radio shows.
Yeah, God. Oh, and same with, that's how I first heard Fly the Conchords. So They were New Zealand guys who go to England to do a radio show in England.
So we were slightly jealous of the UK in many ways. Also, great healthcare over there. It's got to be amazing.
Though they're working hard to try to privatize it and make it as shitty as America's.
Canada's still safe, I hope. So other credits for the writer of this movie, Kerry Kirkpatrick. We have Over the Hedge, other animated movies like that. There is the 2006 Charlotte's Web adaptation. And then he actually worked on the localized scripts for From Up on Poppy Hill and The Secret World of Arrietty. And yes, he is returning to write the 2023 sequel, Dawn of the Nuggets.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. That's good. Okay, man. Wow, that's interesting with those two localized scripts that he wrote. You know, those were late in the Disney deal. I feel like Arrietty was the last one I actually saw in theaters that Disney released. We saw When Marnie Was There Together, actually. So
we
that
did.
Was the last
Poppy
one,
Hill is probably like 2012, 2012 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. That's a weird one.
It's a conflict-free movie.
Well, the conflict is incest.
I don't want to spoil it, but
this is spoiling it.
But it turns out there was no conflict.
You're right, yeah. But Arrietty... That, honestly, I did not like its localization, but mainly because they take out the fucking credit song and put in a Disney, Radio Disney song over it.
I don't think that was his decision.
It was, no, I know. It was
just like how they put in a song in Kiki's Delivery Service or whatever.
Yeah. Two songs, the opening and ending are up. Yeah, it's a blech. But anyway.
So, yes, this guy is hired to write the movie. He's an American. Peter Lord, Nick Park, and Kirkpatrick, they all unite to hash out Chicken Run, and it's fully fleshed out as a parody of every prisoner of war movie ever made, set in post-World War II rural Yorkshire. So it's very specific as to where it is taking place. It's after the war and in Yorkshire.
Yeah, they don't put like a year on screen. It's only when I hear like the music in it, like, okay, this has to be like the 50s or something. Obviously, I don't know Yorkshire from any other town I could name in England. I know so many.
And I think they might be following our real life timeline for Dawn of the Nugget, because based on what the name is and the description I've read, it sounds like it's going to be about the chickens trying to take down factory farming, because it's like, I think Dawn of the Nugget, it's like, oh, processed chicken. Even more chickens are being killed.
Ooh, boy. Ooh.
Yeah. hey, you love fried chicken, Henry.
I do.
Henry's going to be a big old hypocrite cheering for these chickens.
I don't like thinking, yeah, you're bringing me down now, man.
Hey, you know, fake chicken, it's delicious.
Yeah,
and little,
is.
Little
yeah.
Ginger doesn't have to get killed.
Oh, boy, man.
Got to think about it, folks. I like this movie because it is a vegetarian movie.
Yeah, no, it is very, it's right up there with Were-Rabbit, which is also a heavily vegetarian movie, too.
Yeah.
And anti-hunting.
I don't think Peter Lord and Nick Park are vegetarians, though, but you don't want to see them killed, but you can still enjoy a good chicken dinner, I think they want to say at the end.
Yeah.
Real chickens aren't as charming and you know, witty as Ginger and Rocky.
They don't wear knitted hats either. Maybe they'd look cuter if they did that.
Go to a slaughterhouse, put hats on those animals, see what happens. I don't want to be there. So yes, Kirkpatrick adds the outsider's perspective, the American perspective, necessary for a character like Rocky, but also an emphasis on emotion and sentimentality, which Arben doesn't really care about. There's even a big joke about that in A Close Shave, where the potential love interest for Wallace doesn't like the same kind of cheese he does, and then it's over.
You're right, yeah. He's like, oh, well, goodbye.
It all deflates. You're right. And also, they need a love story because there is no love story in The Great Escape.
Yeah, it's well, because it's all dudes. It's a bro-out movie. It's a bro-down in it. No, they... Well, yeah, it's also, I guess, too, it didn't hit me until now. It is a real, like, gender reverse of the Great Escape movies. Like, every major character in it, or almost all, are women. Like, and played by women. It's but that outsider perspective is so important to it, because I think to sell this movie to Americans while still keeping its British soul to it, you need to have just one American who's in there just like, you know what, your accents, man, I can't understand, or something like, who also is kind of a pushy American jerk, you know, as we are.
And I'm sure he wrote the story, but I'm sure all of the British lingo in here, which I'm happy they kept in, is from the Aardman folks.
I would bet, yeah.
There's things I had to look up.
There were a few for me that I was like, what?
But when she says, get the torch, I'm like, I'm glad they kept this in. She didn't say flashlight.
When they said torch, I did think, like, how many meetings did they have to have it be, like, let it stay torch? Because no British person, especially in the 50s, would call it a flashlight.
I think that it helps that Mr. Tweedy immediately pulls out a flashlight. So it's like, it's teaching kids British English, which I love. I love British authors, and I never read the Harry Potter books. I dodged a bullet because the versions available to me were rewritten in American English. And that bristled against my sentiment about, like, I want to read all the dumb slang, and I want to read about HP sauce, not ketchup.
Yeah, yeah. I forgot they localized all those Britishisms away. There should be the Anglophile version of Weebs complaining about that.
I know what a philosopher's stone is. You can't fool me. It's not a sorcerer's stone, goddammit. But again, I didn't read any of those rotten books, and I turned out perfectly fine. We'll be right back.